You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is Chet W. Sisk. I'm an 11-year life coach and the leadership development specialist for a nonprofit called the World Assembly of Youth. I'm going to provide a year of online life coaching for everyone that signs up and becomes a sponsor for our new online leadership development app called the LEAD Course. The course was created for young leaders in emerging countries and new leaders here in the United States. It teaches a model of leadership that includes sustainability, loving kindness, vision, feminine principles, personal empowerment, and connectedness. The tuition for this class is only $50 a year, but in some parts of the world, that's more than a month's salary. We have students in Niger, Bangladesh, Malawi, Namibia, Mongolia, Brazil, and more countries that simply can't afford the $50 a year tuition to take the class. Now, to offset our cost, we need you to sponsor them. If you sign up and donate the $50 sponsor rate, one of the students from the countries mentioned will be able to take the class and further the world into a new direction in leadership. We can win the hearts and minds of young leaders now, while the window is open. Now, this isn't a something-for-nothing proposition. You sponsor them, and we'll provide you with an online life coaching package that will empower you on your path. Go to www.leadtheshift.com, click the Sign Up Now icon, register, then mark the Sponsor button. Be ready to receive your free online life coaching. Once you sign up, your life coaching starts immediately. We are in desperate need of at least 31 of you to sign up as soon as possible. Go to www.leadtheshift.com. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our guest today is Hillary Cash. Hillary is a well-recognized pioneer in the emerging field of internet addiction. In 1999, she co-founded Internet Computer Addiction Services, an outpatient clinic in Washington. In 2008, she co-authored Video Games and Your Kids: How Parents Stay in Control. And in 2009, she co-founded Restart, Internet Addiction Recovery Program, the only therapeutic retreat of its kind in North America that I'm aware of. So, Hillary, welcome back to Answers for the Family.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you back, and one of my first questions is, and again, we spoke, I think it's probably been about 2 years ago, but since that time, has the problem of internet addiction gotten better or worse?
I do think the problem is growing. It's not lessening.
That's what I was afraid of. You know, and I talk with many parents out there, and you know, one of the ones that really comes up probably more than any others, you know, is when they say, my child is already spending too much time gaming or on, you know, or on the internet, What can I do now?
Well, what parents can do and how they should approach it really depends a lot on the age of the child and how long that child has been gaming or apparently addicted to the internet, and what kind of relationship the parent and child have. So it's not just, there's not an easy formula. However, there are some guidelines that parents can follow. Our recommendation is that, and the American Medical Association agrees, that children under the age of 2 just don't need screens in their lives at all.
Okay.
And then from 2 forward, if you want to let your kid watch a little television, that's fine, but our suggestion is no interactive media, which means none of those video games that are designed for kids. And there's research that shows those games designed for very young children actually are harmful rather than beneficial. And then starting at in the elementary years, if parents want to let their kids have some video games to play with, make sure they're not multiplayer games, they're not online. Make sure they're games that can be finished up in half an hour to an hour, and then the kid can be done, put it down, and move on to other things. And the amount of time in the elementary years that kids should have with screens of all sorts, if you lump them all together, television and computers, would be no more than 2 hours a day, ideally. And that's very conservative. It's hard for parents to even imagine that, but that is what's best for kids. And then in the middle school years, you could increase that by an hour. High school, increase it by an hour. But if the kids that you're bringing up won't respect those boundaries, then they need to lose the privilege for a good long time until they've demonstrated that they're more mature and more ready to abide by your rules and your boundaries.
Well, I mean, what makes them, you know, what makes this something that becomes addictive? In other words, for a lot of us, you know, if we've done any studying and dealing with, you know, with drugs and alcohol and stuff, we talk about the chemicals that are actually in it that can become addictive. We're now talking about visually looking at a screen. What makes that addictive?
Well, it's a great question, because I think this is the thing that's hard for even professionals to fully grasp. But most people understand that gambling has the potential to be addictive. And what's the principle that's at work with gambling is this thing called intermittent reinforcement. And that also means the unpredictability of reward. So in gambling, you know, let's say you're playing the slots. You know, you put in your coins or whatever, and you pull down the lever or press the button, and you don't know if you're going to win or lose. And they've designed those machines so that you win enough to want to keep going.
Right.
And that's intermittent reinforcement. And then once in a rare while, you hit the jackpot.
Well, let me ask, but before we go now to the video games, because let me ask about that. Why do you think it is that there are some people that are more susceptible to that type of addiction than others?
Well, there's more and more research that does suggest some people are born with a brain that underproduces dopamine. And dopamine is a neurochemical that we need to function in many areas, but it also is a neurochemical of pleasure. And if our brains underproduce dopamine, we tend to find things that will elevate dopamine to bring us pleasure. And those are individuals who are more susceptible to overdoing it and getting hooked.
Right.
So behaviors can elevate dopamine and opiates and other neurochemicals, as can drugs and alcohol. The same sites, the same pleasure pathways in the brain are being lit up either way. And in the case of video games and other aspects of, you know, internet surfing, going to YouTube, checking out Facebook, even just texting and tweeting. Mm-hmm. Those are all things which will light up this pleasure center of the brain, just as it happens in gambling. And at the most basic level, it's because of intermittent reinforcement, intermittent reward that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And we anticipate being pleased. We might be disappointed, but we anticipate being pleased. And then if we are pleased, we're really happy about it. And that's just going on all the time when you're online. You know, think about opening up your email,
uh-huh.
and you just don't know what you're going to find. And most of the things you're not very pleased with, but every once in a while, there's something you're really pleased with. Same principle at work.
Yeah, that's I guess, why we put up with all the spam. Now, what, I mean, what can we replace? What else can we put in there that will light up the pleasure center so that there isn't that much of a need, you know, to light it up with the computer or with the texting or, you know, whatever, you know, with tweeting and
yeah.
things like that?
Well, one of the things that happens with internet addiction, and as well as drugs and alcohol addiction, is that we come to expect immediate reward, immediate gratification of our desire for pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And we get used to that immediacy.
Right.
So, you know, if you're a gamer, as soon as you sit down and log on, you're expecting to be pleased right away.
Okay.
But in the real world, when you're not drinking or doing drugs, yeah. which please you right away, and you're not gambling or gaming or doing something else online that pleases you right away, you actually have to work harder at creating the experiences that provide you pleasure. Let's just take as an example sexual pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
You can go online and find pornography and be turned on by that and experience a kind of sexual pleasure right away. But if you actually want a relationship which is sexually pleasant and emotionally pleasant,
mm-hmm.
you have to work at it.
Right.
And it takes time to find that individual and court them and build a relationship and so forth. So that sort of illustrates the difference between doing something which is going to bring you a deeper, longer-lasting reward, but it takes a lot longer to get there than the immediacy of online activities.
Well, now, what would be some of the signs of an internet or video game addiction? So versus, you know, just the fact of somebody that just is kind of lazy and wants to just sit there and play versus the actual addiction or the need to be doing that?
Well, all addictions, remember, whether they're behavioral or chemical, are lighting up the brain. They're overstimulating the brain to produce dopamine, opiates, and other neurochemicals that
mm-hmm.
create a high,
right.
and a feeling of a high or pleasure.
Right.
And so all addictions create that high. When the addiction has taken root long enough, then people may not experience so much the high, but at least they're trying to avoid withdrawal symptoms, which are unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings either the high or a sense of relief when they engage in online behavior. All addictions cause people to go into withdrawal when they're cut off. And so if you're an internet addict and suddenly you find you're without access to the internet, you're going to go into withdrawal, just like you do with drugs and alcohol. And that withdrawal is experienced as anxiety, depression, irritability, anger, poor concentration, distractibility. But once you've gone through that period, then you come back to feeling normal and fine and relaxed. So
now,
Wait, can I just finish? The other
critical
thing is that you engage in it despite its negative consequences. This is true for all addictions. So when it comes to internet addiction, the really typical negative consequences are lack of sleep,
mm-hmm.
being chronically sleep deprived, the neglect of family and friends because you'd rather be playing your games or doing whatever you're doing online than actually interacting with real people,
mm-hmm.
a general withdrawal from the world to that withdrawal to that space just in front of the screen, neglect of physical fitness, poor eating habits, sometimes strained tendons in the thumbs or fingers, eye strain, and the neglect of work or schoolwork.
Right.
So these are very typical symptoms.
Now, is there any difference? In other words, we know that there's a lot of things people can get addicted to, and so, for instance, you know, the type of withdrawal that somebody goes through if they're addicted to heroin versus cocaine or versus gambling or internet addiction. I mean, is there a difference as far as a time frame? So, in other words, let's say with a teenager, one of the things, if the parents were to, I mean, go on a vacation. So you go on a vacation to the mountains, you know, for 10 days, you know, and so obviously they're not able to go online, not able to do things. So now they're spending time in nature, they're spending time with the family. And although, let's say maybe they're grumpy in the very beginning, the fact that they're able to come back and realize that, you know, it didn't destroy them, the fact that they couldn't get online or they couldn't play that game, is there sort of a shorter time span, you know, to where they can realize it's okay, or do you need to replace it with something?
I think, replacing it, certainly out at Restart, which is our sort of rehab facility, the guys there go through about 3 weeks, depending on how severely addicted they are,
mm-hmm.
2 to 3 weeks is about the time it takes for them to go through withdrawal and kind of their brains to function more normally, for them to not feel stressed, more relaxed. You know, their brains
right.
are now normal in its functioning. And then certainly while they're with us, we are trying to help them develop interests. For instance, we have them doing CrossFit training every day. They get up early and they do CrossFit training, and they begin to see their bodies transforming. They start to lose weight. They start to gain muscle. They love it, actually. We have a lot of musical instruments there, so they can play. And if they have a background in music, especially, they sort of reconnect with that old interest. We have books in the library. They can read. We do wilderness outings, so they can, and we're set in a very beautiful rural area, so that they can, and some of them do, begin to develop interest in, you know, being in nature, being outdoors. We have animals they can feed, and some of them really are interested in animals and sort of develop new interests. So we're trying to help them gain new interests. And if they go into our phase two program, which is kind of aftercare, then we absolutely want them to be developing whatever new interests they can think of that they might like to try. So these guys are, many of them, discovering the joy of golfing or discovering the joy of wall climbing,
mm-hmm.
Discovering the joy of dancing. So, yes, we know that it's really important for them to develop new interests, but this can take time.
Now, are there some people who are just more susceptible than others, you know, to becoming addicted? I mean, again,
yes.
I was going to say along the same lines as gambling. I mean, you know, there, I can go to Las Vegas and, you know, and take in a show and eat too much, and come back and people say, did you win or lose? And it'll be, well, I didn't play. I mean, it's not even attractive enough to play, or, you know, play, you know, for 5 minutes or something like that. There are other people that talk about the fact that they don't allow themselves to go to Las Vegas because they know that they lose control.
Right, right. Well, in when it comes to internet addiction, there is what we were talking about earlier, is that some people just are born probably not producing quite enough dopamine
right.
in their systems, and so they're more susceptible. So there's there's that susceptibility. But also, there definitely are some things, co-occurring disorders that make people more vulnerable. For instance, if you are someone who has Asperger's, you're somewhere on the autism spectrum,
right,
or you have just some of those autistic traits that make it so that you don't really know how to read social cues, you're not very good socially, in face-to-face interactions, and you've got this other world where you don't have to interact with people except online, that's
right,
someone who's going to be more vulnerable to this.
Makes sense.
If you're someone who has attention deficit disorder, you kind of be more drawn to this because the gratification is immediate and it requires short attention span. You can always, constant distraction. And it works well, gaming works well for that scan and react kind of brain.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody's bipolar, they might, especially when they're in a manic phase, really be drawn to the internet. But also, just people who are depressed and anxious for any reasons whatsoever, this is a good escape. It's legal, it's convenient, it's affordable, and gosh, it's right there in my back pocket on my iPhone all the time. So people who are unhappy and just wish they could get away from their lives are going to be more susceptible.
Okay. And so it sounds like it's also possible that parents could be out there and their children could start having this problem. They could start seeing the fact that they are spending too much time.
I think we just cut out.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We are talking with Hillary Cash, and we're talking about internet or video game addiction. Now, my apologies. My engineer just said that there was a technical problem, so he went straight into the commercial while he checked that out. But I think everything is good. Hillary, are you still with us?
I am indeed.
That is great. And where were we?
I'm not even sure anymore.
Okay. So you were telling us, I think, a little bit about some of the people who were more at risk. We talked about the possibility that some with Asperger's, with ADD, bipolar, people that are depressed may use it as an escape. So what I was saying was that, well, it sounds like that if parents start to see some of this type of addiction going on, it may actually be sort of a pre-warning of other things that are going on that maybe they didn't know or recognize until they started to see this happen. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think that is important for parents to think about, that in general, an addiction develops usually because somebody's trying to escape something uncomfortable. And that something uncomfortable might be no more than just the angst of being a teenager and trying to figure out, a teenager's life. But that there's something that's uncomfortable or painful that this individual is sort of trying to escape from, or they simply might be just drawn in because, you know, their brain works really well and they feel fabulous when they're doing this. So, yes, if parents see kids really spending a lot of time online, and if the kids are fighting over wanting more time and really not able to accept easily the parents' boundaries, mm-hmm. parents should definitely want to look into that, and they might take them to visit a counselor to find out what's going on here.
Now, in the beginning of the show, you talked a little bit about brain development. You talked a little bit in regards to the different ages. And I also know in your book, which I have read for everybody out there, and I highly recommend it, is that you talk about normal brain development. And I believe even in the book you talk about the fact that, you know, many people out there believe that brain development only goes through adolescence, and in reality, I guess it goes in many cases into your 30s. So can this obsession with gaming or with the computer interfere with basic normal brain development for most any age, you know, up through like birth to 30 years old?
Absolutely. And this is the thing I would like parents to understand most, is that remember that we humans have been around a long time, and computers have just been around a very short time. So normal, healthy human development from birth on has nothing to do with computers and the internet. Nothing
right.
at all. But there are certain developmental tasks which require certain kinds of environmental stimulations and social stimulations to bring about the neurodevelopment that children need. So, for instance, in the very beginning, at birth, what is the most important developmental task is for children to bond really well with their caregivers.
Right.
And let's say you're a mom of a newborn, and you know, that child, when that child is fed, be you the mom or the dad, you need to be holding the child in your arms with the bottle or the breast, and mm-hmm. looking into the child's eyes, cooing, interacting. And these are extremely important moments for creating an attachment bond. If the parent is, let's say you're a mom nursing your baby at your breast, mm-hmm. and in your other hand, your attention is actually on your iPhone, and
mm-hmm.
you're using your iPhone to check Facebook and messages and so forth, you're not bonding to your infant. And
see,
even at that subtle but profound level, parents have to understand that kids need attachment, kids need physical activity, and screens can really interfere with kids using their bodies and just being active, because screens are mesmerizing. So kids will be passive in front of a screen rather than running around and shouting and jumping and exploring and, you know, turning somersaults and figuring out how the world works.
Well, you know, I think...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was going to say...
I mean, I could go on and on about
yeah.
this.
Well, I think you... I mean, you bring up a great point, and as you were saying it really got me thinking. I know that, you know, we've kind of gone through this first generation of, you know, with television, you know, and then there was the concern of, you know, our parents, when they're both parents are working, are they putting the child at a young age in front of the television as sort of the electronic babysitter? You know, mm-hmm. so that was the one thing, which kind of got them focused on that. But you brought up another point that I think is very important, and that is now, as we're in another generation to where you have mothers who have iPhones and iPads and everything else, if you're holding your child in one hand and you're doing all of these other things, you know, we now have a secondary level of not only is the child being sort of, you know, shown these types of things, but they're getting some, you know, or what they're not getting from the parent. I mean, you know, that they're getting this, I guess, thought of, you know, I'm not that important if I'm secondary to whatever this machine is in their arms.
That's absolutely right. There's a really good book by Sherry Turkle called Alone Together, mm-hmm. in which she interviews kids, a lot of kids, and it's just heartbreaking. Their stories of how mom or dad will pick them up from school to take them to their baseball practice or their baseball game. And in the past, parents would stand and cheer, you know, way to go, that was nice, wow, you know, all that kind of stuff, which is very rewarding for a child to have their parents' attention. And now, these kids, kid after kid after kid, is describing how the parent is actually sitting there, you know, attention all on the screen, yep. not on what's happening on the field, you know. And it's really sad, because that's what kids need. Kids need an adequate amount of parental attention. And parents are themselves more and more distracted with screens and happy to have their kids be distracted with screens so that they don't have to interact with them, you know, and that they're out of their hair. And it's just a very, very mesmerizing and convenient babysitter.
Well, I mean, what would you suggest? In other words, what do parents need to do so that their children can have a healthy relationship, you know, and still have a relationship with video games and their computer? Because at this point, we know computers are now a part of our lives. That part isn't going away. So what can we do differently to make sure that we're giving enough nurturing, but at the same time, showing them how to have a healthy relationship with their own video games?
Right. Well, if parents, I mean, a lot of this is covered in my book. So parents out there, I do recommend my book. A lot of libraries have it. It's called Video Games and Your Kids, How Parents Stay in Control. So that'll kind of walk you through a lot of this stuff. But just broadly speaking, if I recommend that parents make sure that there's never a screen, TV or computer, in a child's bedroom. Make sure that kids do not have smartphones with internet access until they are older teenagers and have demonstrated good maturity.
Uh-huh.
Make sure that whenever they do decide to let their kids go online, that those computers, that all the family computers have administrative controls set up so that you have to have, you know, the administrator has control over who uses a computer and when, that that computer be in a public part of the house, and that there's monitoring software on the computer which will send parents a message about how much time was spent and where on that computer. So let's say you have a desktop computer that your elementary school kid can use to do school assignments, but nothing else. I would encourage parents to say, nothing else. They don't need a Facebook account when they're in elementary school. They, you know, I don't think they ever do, but if you're going to let your kid have a Facebook account, it shouldn't be until they are probably older teens. But up until then, you want to know where your kid is going. And if they are looking at porn or accidentally discovering porn, you need to know that. And so monitor, make sure there's monitoring on any computer that your kid is using. And those reports sent to you. A couple of good programs are Covenant Eyes or eBlaster. They both will send reports to parents and are pretty hard to hack. So do that from earliest age so kids are just used to it. But you can do it at any age. A kid might not like it, but you can still do it. And just explain, the computer is not private space. If you want a private conversation, have it in person, have it on the phone, but don't have it on the computer because I will be able to read it.
Uh-huh.
So these are just some of the ideas. And again, follow those time guidelines. You know, an hour, hour and a half in elementary school, up to two in middle school, two or three in middle school, three or four in high school. But you have to hold kids accountable to it. So even if your kid is fighting you on it, be firm about the boundary. And if they keep fighting you, then they lose the privilege, and that's that, until some time has passed and you can try it again to see if they've matured and learned the lesson.
Okay. And we have a an email coming in, an email question, which reminds me to tell everybody out there, feel free to, you can call in or you can email in or even instant message in. And this particular question says, I hate to admit it, but after buying my first iPad and iPhone a few months ago, I find myself walking down the street with my nose buried in my new devices. I now resemble the kids I've been criticizing the last few years. Last week, I decided to leave the electronics at home during a walk in the park. The entire time, I had a feeling of a sense of anxiety. It is quite obvious that there is an immediacy or subliminal dependency occurring, and I would love an explanation of how we as a society are going to deal with this obsession. So it sounds like we have a parent now that is recognizing it in themselves.
Right. And I love his or her description of that, because, and it's happened just in a very short space of time. I think this person said
a couple of months ago. Yeah,
and already there's a mild addiction at work. You know, and then the question from this individual was, what are we as a society going to do about it? And I don't really know, because this problem is just going to continue getting worse, I think. But I will tell you that there are individuals who are very much trying to make change, create change at a societal level.
Mm-hmm.
It will be very helpful when we finally get it officially recognized by the folks who put out the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which just came out, and in which internet addiction, it's called internet use disorder, is recognized as being under consideration for later inclusion, but it needs more research. Well, that's at least a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Countries like South Korea and China have made it an official diagnosis, and have both countries have declared it their number one public health threat. And
wow.
South Korea is absolutely impressive in their efforts. They've got a huge problem with it, but they're also really being proactive about dealing with it. And we learned because about all this that I'm going to tell you, because we have had several delegations from South Korea who visited us out at Restart. And what we've learned is that it was a grassroots movement of parents who applied pressure to the government to take action. And the government responded. So we need to get something like that, I think, going here, a real grassroots movement going. And down in the L.A. area, there are a few individuals who are really working with this. And one is a man by the name of Andrew Doan, D-O-A-N.
Uh-huh.
He's a physician, but he himself was a game addict. He's doing great recovery, and he is absolutely on a mission to spread the word. So Andrew Doan is a good resource in the L.A. area.
Okay.
Another good resource is Chris Mulligan, M-U-L-L-I-G-A-N. He's a licensed clinical social worker who is doing lots of work around cyber addiction. He works with parents and teens. So those are two examples of people in your local area that would be great to hook up with and just kind of join. The more people join together to recognize the problem and begin applying pressure at the local level, and then that can filter upward toward the top.
And to add to that, again, as you were giving the resources, you know, if other people have concerns, wherever it is that you are, I think if you go to Hillary's website, which is www.netaddictionrecovery.com, you know, I think that will also help as well. If you go to the site, it's very interactive. You can get around it very easily.
Lots of good information there.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. Lots of good information. Yeah. Now, don't get addicted to going to her site. but, you know, it's if you go there, I think that that will help also, not only in gaining information, but, yes, I would imagine they can contact you as well if they have concerns either for themselves or for their children.
Absolutely. And I can put anyone in touch with other folks. I maintain a listserv of individuals very interested in this problem, and anyone interested could email me and be asked to be added to the listserv. I send out interesting articles that pertain to this, and it is through these connections with one another that I think we will build the grassroots movement needed to start educating the public and really transforming things. But it'll take a while. You know, people are going to have to work hard at it and be patient.
Right. We have another email message that is come across. This one reads, I have three young guys, and then parentheses, in their late 20s, leasing one of my rental houses. The three or four times I have visited them on maintenance issues, you know, at least two of them would be seated in front of the television playing video war games. When I asked them what their hobbies were outside of this, one replied, watching sports, with a caveat that sports was their second choice. The person sending this says, you know, I am in my late 40s. I feel like there must be a definite timeline between our ages when this phenomenon occurred. What is your observation?
Well, definitely there's a generational thing going on here. People who are over, I find that people in their 30s have been exposed usually when they were teenagers to digital technology, and some of them might have gotten hooked. But it's people really in their 20s and younger who are the generation that's grown up with this digital technology, their brains are wired for the technology, and they're the ones who are most profoundly affected by it, for sure.
Now, I know that there, you know, if we go into the news today, I mean, there seems to be an ongoing argument that Hollywood and the video gaming producers, you know, are to blame for an overall increase in violence. What do you think of violence in video games, and where do you stand on this issue?
I think the evidence is actually very strong that interactive violence that you experience through video games reduces a person's level of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
They become inured to killing, to seeing it and participating in it. The military has harnessed this fact and actually produces some of the most successful video games. And when they recruit with the draw of video games, and they promote video games in the military. They've found that they can increase the kill rate. In other words, people's willingness to pull a trigger and kill somebody person to person.
Mm-hmm.
They've dramatically increased that kill rate through the use of video games. So, at the very least, there's lots of evidence about the drop in empathy for people who play those violent games. But there's also a lot of evidence that children, and the younger the child is, the more impactful this will be, become themselves more prone to oppositional behavior, violent behavior, the more they spend time with violent media.
So it sounds like what you're saying is
lots of evidence.
Yeah, but it sounds like what you're saying essentially it's desensitizing us to these levels of violence, to the point that we're not shocked, we're not really emotionally affected by it like we might be if we had not been desensitized.
Well, that is one of the things I'm saying. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely, that is true. And then I'm also saying that aggressive thoughts and behaviors increase just after a short amount of violent video game play. And there's lots of research that demonstrates that. So there is an increase in violent thought and behavior. It might be just, you know, like I've got a problem and I want to hit the chair because I'm frustrated over the problem.
Uh-huh.
Right? And additionally, I think what we have some really important case studies which show that immersing yourself in violent video game play does begin to blur the distinction between the real world and the video game world. Anytime we immerse ourselves too much in video games, and particularly the younger this is happening, the younger the child is, the more there is a lack of moral development of what we call a moral compass, for one thing, that, you know, a sense of morality, because many of the games are antisocial, and so you're not learning any good moral lessons through the gaming. But additionally, there's a blurring between of reality with video, with fantasy. And for people, I mean, most of your listeners will remember what happened in Colorado with the boys who went in and shot up their high school,
yeah,
you know,
Columbine.
Years ago. Columbine. There's a really very interesting psychiatrist who did a very careful analysis of all of their emails and the journals they kept, and really argued very convincingly that these boys were just living out the game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were characters in their game, and this is what they did. So I think there are many, many, many dangers to those violent video games. Gamers themselves defend it and say that's nonsense and I'm not a more violent person. But at the very least, they are going to be a person who is less sensitive and perhaps more antisocial.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I just looked up. We are almost out of time. As anybody who listens to the show knows that we really love success stories. Do you have an example of maybe a severe case that you treated? And can you give us the quick successful outcome?
Well, yeah. We've got a young man who's in our aftercare program. So he's living right now in an apartment. He has a roommate. He is in college getting a 4.0 in his, you know, a 4.0 grade point average, doing marvelously well. And he's become a CrossFit trainer. He's been certified as a CrossFit trainer. He's right now looking for work as a CrossFit trainer. And he's someone who was in college at a prestigious university, got lost in video games, was playing up to 16 hours a day, came for treatment. His parents brought him for treatment. He totally bombed out of college, came for treatment. He left treatment and thought he was all better and went back to college and bombed out a second time. This time, he really, really recognized after he relapsed that he was not at all in control of this and he needed to live a recovery lifestyle all the way. So he came back again, and this time he's just doing fabulously well. And he's, you know, he's really just a great success story, and we so appreciate his willingness to recognize what was going on and come back and get the help he needed. And he's doing great.
Well, Hillary, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on again. To me, it is such an important topic. Thank you not only for what you're doing, but for coming on. Let me, again, for everybody out there, the book, I highly recommend it. It's called Video Games and Your Kids, How Parents Stay in Control. The website, www.netaddictionrecovery.com. If you're driving and you can't run, you know, write any of that down, you know, come to our site, Answers, the numeral 4, thefamilyblog.com. We'll have all the information there. Hillary, again, thank you so much. And for everybody out there, have a great week and be with us next week. Take care now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.